From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The new media are thriving. The old media are dying. That seems to be the theme of our program from week to week to week. But of course, it's all much more complicated than that because increasingly the old and the new are merging into one another. This week, we were playing a show we first aired last fall, which was devoted entirely to the oldest of old media, books. Chances are you'll be buying one soon, but where and how you'll buy it and in what form are open questions.
Nowadays, some 60% of all books are not bought in brick-and-mortar bookstores. They're purchased at airports or checkout counters, Walmart or Costco, Toys R Us or Williams-Sonoma or online. In case you were wondering, 11% are purchased from Amazon.com. The rest are bought at bookstores, but mostly the big chains. The membership of the American Booksellers Association, which serves independent bookstores, has dropped from more than 5,000 to roughly 1,700 in the last decade. Should we decry the state of publishing today?
One of the reasons why it's fashionable or why it's common to decry its state is because most of the major publishing houses are now owned by conglomerates and foreign conglomerates at that.
Sarah Nelson is editor-in-chief of Publishers Weekly.
And they're publicly traded companies for the most part, so there is a demand on the part of editors and publishers to have double-digit growth. You know, it used to be a rich family owned a publishing house, and they published books because they wanted to publish them, not because they expected to make 12%. I mean, in those days, private equity was Nelson Doubleday opening his checkbook.
But nowadays, publishers put their muscle behind books that can sell themselves, and corporate chains like Barnes & Noble and Borders reserve their precious real estate for the highest rollers.
The books on the front table in the stores, and the books on the front page of Amazon also, and other online retailers, they don't just get there because somebody liked them. They get there because they were paid by the publisher for a certain kind of distribution. They call it co-op, and it's product placement, basically.
Whereas when you go into an independent bookseller, you are taken care of by a bookseller.
Avan Domnitz is CEO of the American Booksellers Association.
That is the hallmark of the independent bookseller, that they know the material, they know the books, and that they can discuss them with you.
And that fact has not been entirely lost on readers. Both the independents and online sellers like Amazon offer reviews and recommendations, and in fact,
in the last 4 years, the only segments of the book industry that has maintained or increased market share has been online and independent stores.
That share may increase still more with the development of machines that can produce books in a few minutes in stores on demand. We'll be hearing more about that later on. But Domnitz says new hardware will someday shift the balance back to the little guy.
I think it's a great equalizer. One of the things that the chains did is they brought to the world this enormous inventory that most independents had difficulty matching. Having books available in print-on-demand format, you can walk into any bookstore, large or small, and ask for a book, and as long as it's been digitized, any bookstore can get any book at any time.
Or at least they will. But, says Sarah Nelson, that's precisely the problem, the most serious, most insoluble problem confronting the industry today. Too many books.
It depends whether you count self-published books or not, but it's between 200,000 and 300,000 books a year. You see the problem, which is that even people who want to read books can't begin to get to them, let alone how you begin to publicize and market all of those books.
Frankly, I can't see reducing the number of books. That seems, well, un-American. But I can see the difficulty in cutting through the clutter. There are fewer newspaper book reviews, fewer book shows, and a declining number of forums for public discussion, especially of fiction. The term of art for this problem is disintermediation. Not enough mediators. There are fewer of them, at least in print, but there are plenty of them online and in thousands of living room book clubs across America. And there is one on TV that's worth more than all the others combined, a titanic, omnipotent mediator who tries to use her powers for good.
It's the only book I've ever read that when I put it down, I immediately wanted to read it again. Usually I wouldn't.
You know, I look at the bestseller list every year.
Cecilia Conchar-Farr, professor of English at the College of St. Catherine.
And when Oprah's on hiatus, people read fewer novels. And when Oprah chooses novels and recommends them, more novels top the $1 million mark.
Kanchar Farr studied the phenomenon in her book, Reading Oprah, How Oprah's Book Club Changed the Way America Reads.
I'm jealous. I'm jealous that she can get so many people to read the book she says to read, and I can only get 20 or 25 at a time, the students in my class, and it's only because I have a grade book.
Case in point, Jonathan Franzen, whose family drama, The Corrections, was deemed by academics and other cultural arbiters to be a crossover book that would bridge the audiences for both middle and highbrow fiction. They sang its praises and the publisher obliged with a print run of 90,000. Oprah recommended it, a gift horse that Franzen unceremoniously kicked in the teeth.
The literary establishment brought our whole audience to it and got 90,000. Oprah said two sentences and got over 600,000. And 600,000 people buying that book would put it in the realm of the least successful Oprah books. Anna Karenina, when she chose that, it sold almost 1 million copies that year.
Franzen later apologized. He didn't get it. The publishing industry did, but there are other titanic forces at work, other gift horses the industry has not been so quick to recognize. Like Google Library, Google announced that it will include in its database the full text from some of the world's leading research libraries. When doing searches, users will be able to browse the full texts of public domain material, but only a few sentences in books still covered by copyright. They'll see up to three snippets, a term that has yet to be defined but has provoked furious debate and two lawsuits, one brought by the Authors Guild.
Their attitudes, well, gee, they're making so much money, I'm not making any money. Why should they be allowed to use my work without my permission? Shouldn't they have to pay me? But of course, the fair use doctrine doesn't work that way.
Jonathan Band is an adjunct professor at the Georgetown University Law Center.
What Google is doing is providing a tool that, if anything, will help the publishers. It will make books more relevant than they are today. Because right now, a lot of students, when they are given a research assignment, they just go to Google or another search engine. They don't see books because books are invisible on the internet.
Is there any indication that showing a snippet does hurt the commercial potential of a book? And is there any indication, actually, furthermore, that showing the whole book invariably hurts the potential for selling that book?
So far, if anything, the evidence goes the other way. Some publishers have discovered that the more content that they put online, meaning not just the snippets, but pages or even chapters, that the more readers want to buy the book, that the sampling really does help drive sales.
I think the traditional publishing industry probably serves about 2,000 authors well. Meanwhile, there's 200,000 books published each year. So there's 198,000 authors who really need to find a better way.
Chris Anderson is the editor of Wired and the author of the book and the concept called The Long Tail that predicts, with a steady growth of online sales, that more books will be sold in smaller quantities. The famous example is Touching the Void, a book that languished for years until it soared up the bestseller list on the tail of another book into thin air. All it took was Amazon's observation that people who liked that book might like this other one, too. In these days of disintermediation, marketing is king, free marketing especially, of the kind that occurs online. And Anderson says if you really want to boost sales, make the books free, too. After all, advertiser-supported TV and radio are free, and magazines are so cheap, they might as well be.
Free allows you to maximize your reach. It's basically a form of marketing. And free books get books into the hands of people who wouldn't otherwise read those books.
Yeah, but you don't expect publishers to put ads in books.
Well, I mean, first of all, why not? In the 1950s, Pulp Fiction was all about putting ads in books.
Ick.
And I'm not sure that we shouldn't have a version of the book that is sponsored and could be given away for free by the sponsor.
But he says that's not how most people would buy them. He wouldn't. But why not? He wants options, easy access to out-of-print books, books with ads, books on tape, even e-books, though he doesn't really like them, and digital downloads. He doesn't see a problem with too many books.
You know what? My interests aren't perfectly served by the inventory on the shelves of Walmart. And, you know, thank God I have a choice now.
Last November, the National Endowment for the Arts released a new study about reading. It found reading proficiency declining across the board and that nearly half of Americans, ages 18 to 24, read no books for pleasure. Well, the NEA might not like it, but that's a choice too.
Okay, so at the end of the show, we'll play our staff's favorite picks from the 12-word novel challenge we issued 2 weeks ago. We limited ourselves to just 12 winners, imposing the same rules on ourselves as we did on you. And to be honest, we didn't always agree with the staff or each other.
And if the contest had been for great first lines of novels, the winners would have been completely different. So just to whet your appetite for the dozen winning novels to come, we thought we'd throw you a few entries that we consider great first lines.
John loved his apartment. Then his wife discovered it and ruined everything.
Harvey hated that his parents were vampires, so he married a Catholic.
Insanity didn't run in his family, but you have to start somewhere.
Marvin dances for a living. Betty thinks he works odd hours banking.
Actually, that's a movie. That's that Japanese movie that Richard Gere ruined. What was it called? Chowie Dance. Okay. Audience, I had not read this until just now, so I'm going to do my best. Don't bother Frederick while he's playing his cello, said the severed head.
My uncle? All these months, I thought he was your uncle.
That was just a taste.
Thank you, Lori Eckert, Emily D., Mary Spaniel, Lorraine O'Connor, Rosie Jonker, and Jean Newman.
Up next, the stuff of books, paper, ink, and glue.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In November of 2007, Amazon.com unveiled a new electronic reader device called the Kindle. It's the size of a thin paperback, it weighs 10 ounces, and it can hold thousands of books. Amazon's first offering of Kindle sold out in 5.5 hours, and the device remained out of stock until late April 2008. Now, this isn't the first e-reader device, but one feature Amazon hopes will set Kindle apart is its use of so-called e-ink technology. This, they say, will finally make reading digital text a pleasant experience. Unlike computer screens, e-ink is not backlit. It looks more like actual paper. Michael McCreary, e-ink's vice president of research and advanced development, says the new display is a vast improvement over previous unsuccessful e-readers.
In the early days, in the late 1990s, it took about 200 volts or so, much higher than your actual house current, to create an image. And they were very, very crude images. They were blue, and the images weren't particularly stable. Today, the technology is very comparable to what you would see in a printed newspaper.
Permit me to ask three questions all at once. What does it look like? What does it feel like? How does it work?
The look is just like regular paper. Right now, it is rigid. It doesn't bend like regular paper. But within the next year or so, it'll be thin and feel like regular paper as well. Of course, the difference is, unlike regular paper, you'll be able to change the image. What we're talking about are real pigments, the same kind of pigments you have in ink or in wall paint. And even if you remove the batteries, that image is there for years.
Well, tell me the technology behind it. How does it work?
The principle of the electronic paper is microscopic charged particles, in the primary case, black and white. And it's possible to move either the white to the front or the black to the front. So when you do that at a much smaller scale than you can actually see with your naked eye, what you end up with is something that looks exactly like paper. And the displays that you have on your computer and TV have a light that's on 100% of the time. You're using power all the time, and if you take that computer outside, you can't read it in sunlight. And that's a major disadvantage compared to traditional paper, and that disadvantage is not there with electronic paper.
One of the criticisms of virtual paper is that it doesn't feel like a book or like paper. It's, you know, it's plastic film and it's cold and impersonal and digital.
I'm actually holding an electronic book in my hands right now. It has a leather cover. The book is maybe the size of a paperback in two dimensions, but it's maybe one half or less the thickness of a paperback. And I love the feeling of the leather cover. I love the look of this like paper. This is basically a library in a book. I'll still have my 100-year-old books in my library at home, but I don't carry those on my briefcase to read them when I go out on a business trip.
There seem to be some obvious ecological advantages, no trees killed and so forth. Is that real? What are the implications?
It's absolutely huge. It's been said that if all the newspapers in the United States switched to electronic papers and the forests stayed standing, that we would meet the Kyoto Treaty requirements with those steps alone. So it's very big, especially for paper that's only read once.
Okay, fine. I'm in an airplane. I have my ebook. I'm on page 567 of War and Peace, and things are really getting exciting. Napoleon's on the run, and I run out of batteries. Whom do I kill?
Well, the chances of running out of batteries are very, very small, because you can read thousands of pages on these ebooks without having to recharge your batteries. And the book does not require power to maintain an image, only to change an image. So the chances of finishing your paper book on the airplane and being frustrated because you don't have another book are probably much greater than the chances of actually running out of batteries on your electronic book.
All right, Mike. Thank you so much.
So good to talk to you.
Michael McCreary is Vice President of Research and Advanced Development for E-Ink. People have been predicting the death of print and paper for decades now. Here's Dr. Egon Spengler's take in Ghostbusters almost a quarter century ago.
I bet you like to read a lot, too.
Print is dead.
Oh, that's very fascinating to me. I read a lot myself. I also play racquetball.
Dr. Spengler was a little ahead of his time, but now with the internet, e-readers, and e-ink technology, his prediction should be coming true, right? Not according to National Journal media critic William Powers. In the fall of 2006, as a fellow at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard, Powers wrote a paper called Hamlet's Blackberry, Why Paper is Eternal. He says that paper does a lot more than just fold up nicely.
When you're holding a book with your hands and you're turning that page, the hands are doing a lot of work that the eyes don't have to do. The hands are telling the brain where you are, how much further you have to go, and so forth. When you're working with a screen, your brain has to keep figuring out where you are in the text because it's not physically evident to any other part of your body. It's a very different experience and in many ways less helpful to the brain.
So even cognition is different between reading something on a screen as I am right this second and reading it on a printed page.
Exactly. I mean, what I basically argue in my essay is that paper isn't just a container for content. It actually becomes part of the content. It affects the content because of the way it interacts with the brain. It's a technology, although we don't usually think of it as a technology. And the one attribute that these new inventions bring to the table is refreshability, the idea that they're wired to the web. But I actually think that that quality is in some ways a downside. I think there is something about paper's disconnection from the web that is very appealing to people, the idea that you can't click away to another site, to an email, to something you need to check, that when you have a piece of paper in front of you, a paper medium, you are focused on just that.
Is the allure of turning the printed pulp-based page something intrinsic to the experience, or is it more that we're just habituated to it?
You know, it may happen. I mean, it's true. This is what our brains and our bodies are used to using. However, there are many old-fashioned devices that people have been predicting would go away for generations. I cite a professor from California named Paul Duguid who talks about the hinge. Futurists have been predicting the death of the hinge for generations. Science fiction movies since time immemorial, and stories have always had sliding doors, doors that disappear into walls, no hinges. Hinges are old-fashioned. Doors that are on hinges take up space needlessly and so forth. And yet the hinge lives on because hinged doors do things for people that they like. They are expressive. You can slam doors. You can use doors to send messages. There's something about hinges that continue to work for us. And I argue in the paper, and I know many other people sort of feel this, I think, in their guts when they use paper. There is something about paper that really, really works, that has worked for 2,000 years, and it's going to be very hard to replace it.
Couldn't this all come down just to the mundane issue of cost, that it's just a lot cheaper to do things digitally than to deforest the landscape?
Yes, that could well kill off paper. I think it is already killing off certain kinds of paper media. In fact, I get into this in the essay. There are kinds of content that don't require paper. And I actually think the most of what newspapers do, the breaking news function, is much better suited to digital media. And this is why people have migrated to the web for breaking news and are moving away from newspapers. That intuitively makes perfect sense to me. The one thing that newspapers do that doesn't work as well in digital media is the longer form kind of journalism, feature stories, longer investigative pieces.
But magazines, you think, have a better chance of surviving in their non-digital form. And books as well, I suppose. Is the future of books on pulp-based products indefinitely?
I think books have the greatest chance of surviving on paper, some kind of paper, maybe not pulp-based. And there are green papers that I have used that are almost a kind of plastic that are wonderful and that really work and that could be, if paper is staying with us, could be the future of paper. You know, all these e-books and e-readers that are being developed, what they're all trying to do is what a book already does. And where I think magazines might one day find a vehicle online that matches the paper version, I really have doubts about books.
Okay, so you wrote this piece, which I'm sorry to report I read on a computer screen. And it makes some pretty interesting assertions about our relationship to paper and its future. What has been the reaction?
The reaction was surprising to me in that a lot more people were interested in this paper than I expected. And I continue to get email from fans of paper. Almost everybody who writes me says, thank you. You know, I've been waiting for someone to weigh in on paper.
And let me ask you a question. Have any of the congratulations come in the form of nice notes on stationery?
Yes. Some people have written me on very nice pieces of paper. I must also say a lot of the people who email me make a point of telling me that after downloading the PDF, they printed it out before reading it. I love that.
Well, Bill, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. I enjoyed it.
William Powers wrote Hamlet's Blackberry, Why Paper is Eternal, as a fellow at the Shorenstein Center for Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University.
New technology has been developed to ensure that paper books survive. Time Magazine and Reader's Digest have just named the espresso book machine one of the top inventions of 2007, though its creation spans nearly three decades. Costing about $140,000 and the size of a very small car, it's a bookstore, a very, very big bookstore in a box. Daniel J. Kramer has the story of the EBM.
In 1989, Harvey Ross was a management consultant for the communications industry. He was conducting research into how radio, TV, and publishing would be affected by emerging technology when lightning struck.
I remember him sticking his head in my office one day and told me about this idea he had, which is what became the book machine.
Bruce Babler was a longtime friend of the late Harvey Ross.
He came up with this notion of being able to generate a book on demand. He was so captivated by the idea that he significantly curtailed his consulting practice and jumped headfirst into refining, getting a patent, and deploying the system.
Ross went looking for people who could make his vision of printing books on demand a reality. In St. Louis, he found patent attorney Bill Cunningham, and together they hammered out a concept patent for storing books on a computer and printing them as needed. But vision only takes you so far. That's where inventor Jeff Marsh fits into the picture.
Harvey needed someone that could take the concept and create working hardware.
Marsh had previously worked in the automotive industry and approached the idea of making a machine that can print a book on demand with eyes unclouded by the publishing world. And those eyes saw the biggest obstacle to printing high-quality books on demand, the glue.
I started looking at some of the processes that went into making a book, and I recognized that the gluing of the spine, if you will, or the binding process, was not going to work for a book machine. And what wound up on that is I conceived ultrasonic binding.
Obviously. In traditional bookbinding, hot glue is continuously replaced and refreshed. It's never compromised by being too long on the boil. But in the world of on-demand publishing, it's hard to predict how many books will be produced. Glue kept hot for too long gets too thick and less adhesive, and also leaves a terrible stench in the air.
And that's what drove me to say, hey, we need a way to have glue in its fresh state. And then we need to energize that glue real quick and then have it melt into the pages and into the cover of the book and set up real quick.
Marsh produced a machine that hit the glue with a concentrated burst of energy to bind the pages together. Problem solved. Finally, they had a machine that could print any book in 5 to 7 minutes. This meant, in theory, that no book ever had to go out of print, following Jeff Marsh's mission statement of
any book, anywhere, anytime.
Ross and company now had the hardware for instant publishing, but had nothing to publish. Ross dove into the book world in hopes that someone with enough clout would see how his machine could change the world. And that's where Jason Epstein fits in. The former editor of Random House was trying to find a way to offer consumers classic literature that had become hard to find in the new mega mall bookstores of America.
I created a mail-order catalog with about 40,000 backlist titles in it, which readers could order over an 800 number. At first, it was a very successful venture. We sold lots and lots of catalogs and a great many books, and discovered after a year or so that we were losing money on every sale just because it was so expensive to handle individual orders physically.
Epstein folded his mail order business, but still, he knew there had to be a way to get
any book, anywhere, anytime.
Then he heard about Ross's machine.
I went out to see it, and it did exactly what I had anticipated such a machine should do. And I said to myself, well, this now transforms the publishing business. It replaces the whole Gutenberg structure that had existed for 500 years.
Jason Epstein teamed up with an old friend, former Dean & DeLuca CEO Dane Neller, to form On Demand Books. They licensed Marsh's machine, dubbing it the Espresso Book Machine. It's like an ATM for literature. Just as an ATM can deliver money in any currency, the EBM can furnish books in any language. Jason Epstein.
The 40 million Hispanic people in the United States who are underserved by the existing book distribution system would now be able to download books in their own language.
And it can relieve any publisher hit with an unexpected bestseller. Kerry Goldstein, director of publicity, 12 books.
Our first printing, For God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, was about 40,000 copies. Within about a week of publishing that book, we went back for print about three times, and we're up to 90,000 copies in print. Books sold so quickly that there was about a week where books were not available, but having these print-on-demand machines would make them immediately available to people.
This machine is not designed for the indecisive reader. It's for people who know exactly what they want. But there is a certain pleasure in entering a bookstore with no particular purchase in mind. It's called browsing. E-books and audiobooks have their place, but we like to touch and smell and see. Fred Bass owns The Strand in Manhattan, which proudly boasts over 18 miles of books.
There's something that's very attractive about looking at a dust jacket on a book or the color of the book or the way it's bound that makes the book more interesting, and determining just by handling the books whether you really want to read it or not.
Currently, there are 6 EBMs in the world. The first one was at the World Bank. Now it's at the Library of New Orleans, where it will help replace the books washed away by Katrina. There's one at the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, another at the University of Alberta in Canada, one in Australia, another one in San Francisco, and the 6th is moving from the New York Public Library to the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester, Vermont. There, over 200,000 public domain titles will be available instantly thanks to the EBM. Now, instead of spending years tracking down Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, you just print it out, go home with a copy of it in your back pocket, and finally read it. For On the Media, I'm Daniel J. Kramer.
Up next, reading and not reading War and Peace. And we'll finally present our favorite 12-word novels.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The newspaper book review is facing a crisis. Fewer pages, shorter takes, pressure to cover bestsellers, and some papers have done away with the section altogether. Steve Wasserman is the former book review editor at the Los Angeles Times. He wrote about the plight of the book section in the Columbia Journalism Review. He says a handful of papers still devote ink to reviewing books, namely the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the San Francisco Chronicle. But barring that list, the book section is in a dismal state.
Most newspapers, if they bother to review books at all, consign them to a virtual ghetto. You're lucky at most newspapers to get a quarter of a page, maybe a column, half a page, much less an entire Sunday supplement.
You want not only more coverage, but more literary coverage. What should daily newspapers, in your view, be doing?
It seems to me that what newspapers ought to do is to respect the intelligence of the audience and speak to them as grown-ups. We ought not to pander to the bestseller list. After all, news of those books is already pretty obvious and pretty widespread, but we ought to focus on those kinds of books which, in the judgment of editors and reviewers, are neglected but are nonetheless worthy of people's attention.
I particularly understand the urge to resist, the marketing department's desire that you do bestsellers that appeal to the broadest possible audience. But you must agree that to the extent that you go for more arcane or obscure or more literary fiction and nonfiction, that you are going to narrow the overall audience at a time when narrowing audiences are killing newspapers.
No, I don't accept that whatsoever. I'll give you an example. About a decade ago, Penguin Classics decided to publish a translation of some of the work of a Mexican nun and saint named Sor Juana de la Cruz. I'd never heard of Saint Sor Juana de la Cruz, except I had remembered a few years before Carlos Fuentes, the great Mexican writer, telling me that my ignorance of her work would be as if in the Spanish-speaking world you'd said the word Shakespeare and got a blank stare. So when I learned that Penguin was going to publish a translation of this influential writer, I thought, well, that's news. When I showed the cover of the book review and to my minders at the LA Times, they looked at me in some considerable astonishment and said, Sor Juana who? Then when I went into the executive dining room of the Los Angeles Times, the Mexican-American waiter, his eye fell upon the cover and he exclaimed, Sor Juana. And I looked at him and I said, you know who this is? He says, of course, every school child in Mexico knows who this is. So we published this piece, and I was flooded with letters. A third of the readers of the Los Angeles Times, it turns out, Spanish was their first language, saying, at last, the Los Angeles Times is respecting their culture. So, what's popular? What's elitist? You tell me.
In your own piece, is it pains to point out that the audience for the book review has always been tiny and sort of self-selecting. Can a daily newspaper sustain a robust book review section when there is no natural market for its contents?
Most newspaper sections, if separately accounted for, do not pay their way. Nowhere is the demand raised that, say, the sports section ought to be carrying advertising by the teams they're charged with covering. And no one is raising the cry that the business section, often the receptacle of vast tabular data, begin to carry advertising from the very corporations they're charged with covering. Only the lowly book review is it thought appropriate to demand publishers provide enough advertising to justify the journalism that appears in the pages. It's ridiculous.
Okay, point taken. But I kept feeling in your piece in CJR that you were on the verge of saying something that you never quite said, namely that if newspapers would actually just market themselves right, they could turn their book sections into actual profit centers. Is that doable?
I suggest that it might be possible, but it's never been done, except for the New York Times, which has three sales representatives dedicated to book review advertising. To the best of my knowledge, no other newspaper employs a single person who wakes up in the morning trying to figure out a strategy by which they could make the book review section profitable. The readers of book reviews are among a newspaper's most prosperous and best educated readers. That's a demographic that also goes wandering among the Ralph Lauren ads that are provided in other sections of our major newspapers. Enlightened editorial leadership, enlightened managers of newspapers understand that.
This is all endlessly depressing, and the digital revolution is clearly one of the culprits here. But doesn't that very same revolution open up vast opportunities for book reviews, literary and otherwise?
One thing the internet has demonstrated is that there is a considerable hunger and avidity for cultural news of all kinds, not least of which is news of books. And books, I must say, have yet to be bested as the single most accessible instrument for the conveyance of deep knowledge and lasting entertainment. And the news of those books should be promoted, in my judgment, by the newspapers whose purpose it is to provide the news of the day.
Well, Steve, I very much appreciate you sitting down with us.
Happy to do so.
Steve Wasserman is the managing director of the New York office of the literary agency Niram & Williams at Fish & Richardson. He is the former editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review.
Last fall, not one, but two new translations of Leo Tolstoy's sprawling epic War and Peace were published, inciting raging debate in the world of letters. The first, by Andrew Bromfield, is the version originally serialized in a Russian journal, before Tolstoy tinkered with it, adding some 400 pages. The second, by the husband and wife team of Richard Pevere and Larissa Volokonsky, is the complete version. And if the Amazon.com sales rankings are any indication, that's the one that people are after. Newsweek called War and Peace the Everest of literature. Marilyn Monroe, it said, lugged it onto a Hollywood set to demonstrate her intellectual chops. But the question remains, how many of us have actually read it? Surely here in New York, the publishing capital of the world where the literati abound, there must be plenty.
I have not read War and Peace.
War and Peace. Oh, it sounds like it would be the most phenomenal book in the universe, but I'm telling you, the size of it is a little daunting.
I've considered it, but it's way too long to read.
I guess I haven't read it because I haven't had a need to read it.
Maybe when I find some time during retirement or a large stretch of time to go through it.
I think after this conversation, I might actually consider reading it.
Wait, we found one.
The character development is really good, but I can't really say what it was, what it really was about. I mean, war and peace. But otherwise.
Well, maybe we asked the wrong people. Last October, the New York Times launched Reading Room, a blog that functions more or less as a book club, and chose for its first selection, you guessed it, War and Peace. In his final post, Times executive editor Bill Keller wrote, quote, "Like my fellow panelists, I felt wistful coming to the end. But to say you want more is not to say the book ended before its time. The characters had grown up before my eyes, becoming real and complicated and, mostly, better."
Keller wasn't the only journalist who made War and Peace his pet project. We caught up with Newsweek arts editor Malcolm Jones, who finished the long version, thank you very much. So what do you want, a merit badge?
There ought to be a merit badge just for having done it, although that makes it sound so much more unpleasant than it is, because it's not an unpleasant book.
Well, what is it then?
It's a book that doesn't fit easily into the way we live now because we're so used to speed, and this is a very long, leisurely book. Now, what makes it so much of a pleasure to read is that after you get through about 100 pages, it clicks in. I mean, you've done all the work pretty much until then, trying to keep everybody straight. And at that point, Tolstoy just takes over. And after that, you just can't stop. And you've still got 1,100 pages to go.
And you had the classic experience of reading War and Peace over the summer, which you did for the first time. And you've been reading classic literature your whole life. You've made a career in part as a book critic.
And hiding this dark, dirty secret from everyone.
So before we go any further, I should confess that although I'm fairly comfortable with Russian literature, I never read War and Peace. So could you tell me, and whatever listeners out there are in my boat, briefly what it's about?
It's about a group of nobles and their families and their rising and falling fortunes. During the Napoleonic Wars, there's a huge battle scene about 200 pages in, and then there's the siege of Moscow and the Battle of Borodino. After you've gotten another 500 or 600 pages, you have more battle. You know, the whole idea that these people only exist within the confines of this book is something that you just don't even think about. They seem like people that you know as well as you know your neighbors or your relatives. One of the most memorable scenes is when, for example, a young girl first falls in love. And, you know, you're thinking, here's a man in the middle of the 19th century writing about basically a teenage girl, and she is a complete figure on the page. I mean, there's something about the way he writes that just convinces you that, yes, this is exactly how it is.
If somebody asked, why must I read this book, would those be the reasons, or would you add some more?
One I know I would add would be, out of the context of the book, it sounds like Tolstoy is preaching, which when you're reading the book, it doesn't feel like that. But you definitely get the idea that he's making a point about war. He attacks the idea that there is such a thing as a great general. He is very much against the great man or great person theory of history. He thinks that events collide and coincide and people do strange things and for want of a shoe, the battle was lost kind of thing. It's much more chaotic on a battlefield than people are willing to admit. And you know, the people I know who have been in battle all confirmed this. And Tolstoy himself had been in battle. So he was, you know, he was a soldier himself and knew what it was like. It's not a point you see very much. So it is. This is a very unique aspect to this book.
You've said that War and Peace continues to find readers almost in spite of its translators. So do you think that a native Russian would suggest that what we read in translation isn't really War and Peace at all?
Well, famous Russians have insisted this. I mean, Nabokov said more or less that, and Joseph Brodsky has said more or less that, you know, that what we read in English is very flat and doesn't really capture the Russian. I would say that the one by the couple, Pavir and Volokhonsky, the newer one, is the one that would ring the truest to me.
Even though most of us might not have read War and Peace, it certainly seems to have permeated the pop culture. There's a reference to it in Seinfeld when Elaine says that the original title was War, What's It Good For? It was referenced in Goodbye Columbus as the book that one character always sets out to read every single summer. Can you think of more?
There's a very famous episode of Cheers where Diane wins a bet with Sam, and the result of losing the bet is that Sam has to read War and Peace. And at the very end of the show, he's in his office lying on a couch. He's just completely exhausted, and Diane is across the room like nattering on about something. And in the course of talking about, you know, extolling War and Peace, and she says something about the movie, and he pops off the sofa like somebody out of a Jack-in-the-Box, and he says, "There's a movie?"
Malcolm, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Malcolm Jones is a longtime book critic and arts editor at Newsweek.com.
Oh, yeah. Well, they say the first 800 pages are a little bit slow, but it shoots right off after.
Wait a second. What are we talking about? I got 5 days. How long is this book?
Well, I've delivered a few for the book clubs, and it's about 3.5 pounds paperback.
Forget it, Sam. Nobody can read 4 ounces a day.
Last fall, we offered you, the listeners, a challenge. We asked you to write a novel in 12 words, and you responded in droves. Among the contestants, three high school English classes in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Bradford, Vermont, and New York City.
We noticed some trends. There are a fair number of poets and punsters among you, and a lot of you seem to be inclined toward despair and death. I don't know if we attract that sentiment or cause it. And some of you went meta, making the game about the game. For instance, Bruce Minturn of Seattle wrote, 6 words into his first novel, Sam's lonely wife murdered him.
In any case, we did try to set some rules for judging. For instance, we thought the winners ought to have characters and plot, but we hold no sway over OTM producers who made the final selection. So what you will hear are the most intriguing or satisfying entries chosen by the names you hear at the end of the show. Our top 12 12-word novels.
She hated Ohio. She ran away. She loved the dead jazz musician. By Rudy James.
Living Abroad. By Marsha Veach. This is China. This is China. This is China.
I see now that I have taken lighthouses for granted. By April Kuiper, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
My sister had written father's obituary. He is survived by one daughter. By Brenda J. Wolfe.
His enormous lottery winnings enabled him to create his own private hell. By Pamela Roller, Litchfield Park, Arizona.
Louise's love of poodles was overshadowed only by her love of barbecue. By Mark Weaver, Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
Obituary. First 5 words free. She thought, Charles dead, yacht for sale. Angela Strucker, Brooklyn, New York.
In the end, they barely reached Buffalo before finding themselves devastatingly incompatible. By Carol Braun, Garfield Heights, Ohio.
There are no atheists in foxholes, said the chaplain, so get out. Jonathan Swiller, Highland Mills, New York.
Well, I warned her. Chickens do not like to ride in cars. By Janine Farrell, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Got Grandpa's FBI file. Curiosity sated, Pop's backstory regains renewed luster. By Michael Ravnitsky, Silver Spring, Maryland.
12-word novel win changes life. Fame, drugs, adultery, sorrow, tears, blood. By David Hill, New York, New York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.